Hi, I'm Ben Rizzuto, wealth strategist at Janus Henderson Investors. For 90 years, we've worked to help clients achieve superior financial outcomes and fulfill our purpose of investing in a brighter future together. To learn more, go to janushenderson.com.
In an historic vote, Kevin McCarthy is ousted from his post as Speaker of the House. It's the first time in U.S. history that's happened. And FTX founder Sam Bankman-Fried appears in court as his financial fraud trial begins.
Probably the most notable thing is that when Bankman-Fried entered the courtroom, he very clearly got a major haircut. And so it's a bit of a different image of Bankman-Fried than we've seen previously. But otherwise, he's been cooperating with the judge's instructions, standing when told to and sitting when told to.
Plus, how criminal gangs are exploiting security gaps at airports. It's Tuesday, October 3rd. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal. This is the PM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories that moved the world today. In an unprecedented move for the chamber, the House of Representatives has voted to oust Kevin McCarthy from his post as Speaker.
On this vote, the yeas are 216, the nays are 210. The resolution is adopted. Without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid on the table. The office of Speaker of the House of the United States House of Representatives is hereby declared vacant.
It was the culmination of a long-running feud between House GOP leadership and hardline members of the party. Joining me now with more is Wall Street Journal national political reporter Eliza Collins. Eliza, there were a few surprises in the way this vote came down. Where does this leave us now? We don't have much of a blueprint for what happens next, or do we?
We have no blueprint for what happens next because this has never happened in history. We are really in unprecedented territory here. There were some surprises. There were 8 Republicans who joined with all Democrats in voting to oust McCarthy. Some of them we had expected. It's part of this group of hardline conservatives who have felt like McCarthy did not do enough of his promises when he first became Speaker. Basically spending cuts, other things they had requested. They do not want any more aid to Ukraine. They felt he had not done enough to basically make a more conservative House majority. But a big surprise was Congresswoman Nancy Mace. She is a congresswoman from Charleston, South Carolina. She's been fairly moderate. It is a swing district, although it leans Republican. She's socially liberal. And she said that she voted to oust McCarthy because he had not brought up votes, including on things like women's issues. She's been very critical of how the party talks about abortion. So it wasn't just conservatives, although it mostly was that group of hardline members who had been pushing McCarthy for a long time.
What are the immediate next steps we are aware of?
As soon as the vote closed, the Speaker of the House was vacant. McCarthy was no longer the Speaker of the House. Patrick McHenry, a longtime McCarthy ally and a member of Republican leadership, took over as the Speaker pro tempore. And then he sent everyone back to meet with their own parties. So we expect now, eventually, an election for Speaker. McCarthy could try for this again. Someone else could step up. But there's real uncertainty. My colleagues at the Capitol said members walked out just stone-faced and said they don't know what happens now. Democrats stuck together and really a pretty amazing display of unity in voting with those 8 Republicans to oust McCarthy. But they don't know what happens next either. And so we're really in this territory where no one has put their name forth that says they want to be Speaker. We'll just have to see what comes next.
What could this mean for the unity of the Republican Party?
Well, what's really interesting here is the party is mostly unified. It was only 8 Republicans who voted to oust McCarthy, but they had this amazing power because McCarthy, if you'll remember, really struggled to be elected Speaker in the first place because of most of these members, and they made a deal. And part of that deal was that any one member could bring up a vote to oust McCarthy. Now, this was something that had been around previously, had not been used in any serious way, but under Democrats, they got rid of it. So McCarthy agreed to bring it back, and it ended up backfiring on him. So a small number of his opponents were able to take him out, and Democrats, but most of the caucus is unified.
To that point, Eliza, what could this mean for Democrats?
There you're waiting to see right now. They've been arguing for a long time that Republicans have been causing chaos with the different factions of the party. And I expect we can see that President Biden will make that argument on the campaign trail. Former President Donald Trump did not come out outright and saying he supported McCarthy, but as the vote was going on, he posted on Truth Social, his social media platform, that Republicans always had chaos. So that was sort of an indirect support of McCarthy. You know, the front runner for the Republican nomination was not out there making a full-throated defense of the House Speaker. There is lots of simmering division.
That's Wall Street Journal national political reporter Eliza Collins, and we'll have much more analysis to come on WSJ.com and on our AM edition of What's News. Jury selection began today in the trial of Sam Bankman-Fried, owner of the collapsed crypto exchange FTX. He's facing more than half a dozen criminal charges, including allegations he stole billions of dollars from customers and used them to enrich himself. Bankman-Fried has pleaded not guilty to all of those charges. Joining me now with more from outside the courthouse in Manhattan is Wall Street Journal cryptocurrency reporter Caitlin Ostroff. Caitlin, let's start with jury selection. This is a high-profile case. What are some of the factors both sides are keeping in mind during this phase?
Judge Lewis Kaplan, who's presiding over this case, is actually the one who's doing the jury questioning and selection, but with questions provided by both the defense and the government. And so a lot of them have been basic questions so far of, what have you heard about this case? Do you recognize the people in this room? And then they've been kind of just going through the general stuff so far of, do you have any conflicts that could prevent you from sitting for this trial, which is expected to be upwards of 6 weeks in length. We expect that there may be some more questions focused on Sam Bankman-Fried, and so they, you know, had him stand up at one point and ask people, do you know who this person is? Do you work for a company, or do you have any interaction with companies that have either invested in FTX or lost money to FTX? And then the defense and the government had provided some questions on what people knew about cryptocurrency, had they invested in it before. We haven't gotten there yet, and it's unclear whether that will be part of the questions.
And how did Bankman-Fried respond to the proceedings? How did he appear?
Probably the most notable thing is that when Bankman-Fried entered the courtroom, he very clearly got a major haircut. Bankman-Fried is kind of known for having like this really thick, voluminous, dark, curly hair, and that's been cut down quite significantly. It's probably about an inch and a half from maybe the 3 or so inches it used to be. And so he looks a bit different. He seems to have lost some weight. He's wearing a black suit in the courtroom, which kind of hangs off of him a little bit. And so it's a bit of a different image of Bankman-Fried than we've seen previously. But otherwise, he's been cooperating with the judge's instructions, standing when told to and sitting when told to.
Caitlin, already ahead of this trial, several former FTX employees have pleaded guilty to charges against them. How is that likely to impact Bankman-Fried during his trial now starting?
Three people who have pleaded guilty to government charges, the former head of the trading firm that Bankman-Fried founded, Alameda Research, and two engineers who worked with Bankman-Fried, have pleaded guilty. They're cooperating with the government, and so it's expected that they will testify against Bankman-Fried during this trial, although it's not clear when that would happen. And so that's going to be testimony that the jury will have to consider, and then we'll open them up to cross-examination by the defense. Caroline Ellison, the former CEO of Alameda, is expected to be one of the most significant witnesses in this case, but there are likely to be others as well.
That's Wall Street Journal cryptocurrency reporter Caitlin Ostroff. You can hear a lot more from Caitlin about Sam Bankman-Fried's trial on the Journal podcast. She'll be reporting on all the big developments as it unfolds in a special series called The Trial of Crypto's Golden Boy. Episodes drop in the Journal podcast feed wherever you listen. We'll link to it in our show notes. Coming up, aviation officials are facing a new challenge, rooting out criminal gangs who are recruiting airport workers. More after the break.
The Claude 3 model family from Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. With models at every point on the price-performance curve, you no longer have to make trade-offs between intelligence, speed, and cost. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence, Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed, and Haiku is the fastest and lowest-cost model on the market, perfectly designed for high-volume, high-speed use cases. Join the thousands of enterprises who trust Anthropic to keep them at the frontier. Visit anthropic.com/Claude today.
Demand for air travel has been surging, and airports have been dealing with short staffing, flight disruptions, and more. Now add to that list criminal gangs. Aviation authorities and law enforcement officials say airports have increasingly become a recruiting ground for criminals because of airport workers' access to secure areas. Joining me now with more is Wall Street Journal aviation reporter Ben Katz. Ben, how big of a problem is this for global airports?
We've spoken to a lot of people in law enforcement, aviation agencies, trade industry bodies, and, you know, this is a topic that keeps coming up. This concern that since this recovery in air travel and this rapid hiring across airports and airlines, you know, across the world, that there are opportunities that criminal organizations might look to utilize in order to expand their own operations that were disrupted during the pandemic. So what we're seeing is really this consciousness around this increased threat environment that people are getting worried about.
Is this a global issue?
We've found examples across the US, in the US Virgin Islands, but also in Belgium, in Portugal, in Canada, in the Philippines. You know, this is something that's really, you know, really broad as organized crime is really operating across the world. We found some data from ISAR and Aviation Security Consultancy has said that they've tracked 48 serious incidents involving airport insiders in the 9 months of this year. And that's compared to 35 across the whole of last year. So really taking note of a significant increase.
So let's talk about the recruitment aspect. What's making airport workers attractive targets for these criminal enterprises?
There are multiple factors at play. One thing that security agencies and specialists point to is this really rampant dissatisfaction amongst airport workers in the kind of chaotic recovery in the industry, right? There's been a lot of staffing shortages, there's been low wages, furloughs and redundancies, and all of these dynamics, they say, kind of create almost like a lack of loyalty towards their employers, which could open them up to recruitment. Combined with that is the cost of living crisis that's happening in many countries, high rates of inflation. At the same time, there's rapid hiring, which is giving opportunities to organized crime to either place their own accomplices at the airport or alternatively to just giving them more options to approach new faces. All of these factors combined are really what the law enforcement agencies are pointing to when they talk about this increased threat.
So how are the authorities trying to get a handle on this?
A lot of it is education. A lot of it is going out to airports, meeting with managers and workers and trying to explain what to look for, what kind of culture you want at the airport. In the US, very interestingly, the TSA is in the process of rolling out new measures that will involve screening of airport employees, similar to the kind of screening that passengers go through.
Is there anything consumers, air travelers should know about the risks?
I think the first thing to say is that this isn't everybody. Right. The number of bad actors at airports, it's really a small percentage. You know, we definitely don't want to kind of exaggerate or make anybody feel like they need to worry every time they go to the airport. That being said, really basic, just security and awareness could go a long way, really.
That's Wall Street Journal aviation reporter Ben Katz. We report exclusively that Amazon used a secret algorithm, codenamed Project Nessie, to test how much it could raise prices in a way that competitors would follow. That's according to redacted portions of the Federal Trade Commission's monopoly lawsuit against the company. People familiar with the allegations in the complaint say the algorithm, which is no longer in use, helped Amazon improve its profit. The FTC declined to comment on the redactions, but called on Amazon to remove them. In a statement last week, a top Amazon lawyer said the FTC is misunderstanding how online pricing and competition work. And finally, if you're looking for news about the Federal Reserve, social media might not be the first place you turn to. But the central bank is hoping to change that.
Hi, I'm Jay Powell. I'm the chair of the Federal Reserve. And I want you to know that the Federal Reserve is now on Instagram and Threads.
That's from the Fed's first video post on its new Instagram account, at Federal Reserve Board. The Federal Reserve declined to elaborate from its press release. But reporter Suryatapa Bhattacharya says it's likely an attempt to connect with younger audiences. So how's the new account doing?
The responses have been pretty cute. I saw one where a user, an Instagram user, commented that this was the first time they'd seen Mr. Powell so casually dressed. And it was just him without a tie, but he was wearing a suit.
And it seems the Fed could be taking some tips from other central banks that have been on Instagram already. Here's Surya again.
Some of the responses on the European Central Bank pages do look like they have been successful in their outreach, because you do have younger folks asking questions like, how do I use a 500 euro note, or what does the ECB do? So you do see that there is some history there with social media use amongst central banks that receive the kind of response I think they're looking for from young people who are looking to understand more about the economy.
And that's what's news for this Tuesday afternoon. Today's show was produced by Pierre Bien-Aimé and Anthony Bansi, with supervising producer Michael Kosmides. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal. We'll be back with a new show tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening.
Enter a revolutionary business world where AI meets power with Intel Core Ultra and Intel vPro. Imagine PCs that boost productivity, creativity, and collaboration with cutting-edge AI. They're gateways to innovation, engineered with powerful AI performance, hardware-based security, and AI-powered threat detection. Plus, they're built sustainably and can be managed remotely. Transform your workflow with Intel Core Ultra and Intel vPro today. No product can be absolutely secure. Become an IT hero at intel.com/ITheroes.